Ladies and gentlemen, this great political campaign is fast drawing to a close. A great decision hangs in the balance. A decision that may determine the choice between peace or war, prosperity or depression. This great decision as to the future policy of our country cries out for a frank discussion of the issues. Decision-making requires facts from which to judge. Yes, we need to talk sense, not nonsense. We need to hear facts, not fiction. And we as Americans need to face reality, not theory. The purposes of an American system of elections are not served by just plain, raucous, and irresponsible campaigning. Neither are those purposes served by silence, by plain refusal to campaign. Neither of these tactics faces the issues. Neither is honest. And where issues are not faced, the purposes of the American political system are not served. No system can work which refuses to face the facts and discuss the issues. And no system can work if it is run by men who refused to face up to the issues and to discuss them honestly. Now let's talk a little about this campaign in Minnesota. Democracy in Minnesota has always been strong. The Minnesota political tradition is a vigorous one, and we can well be proud of its contribution to American democracy. But I am compelled to say that the incumbent Republican governor's campaign has been a flagrant repudiation of this noble tradition. It has been a denial of the most important democratic right of all, the right of every citizen to vote on the issues involved with full knowledge of those issues. Now, the campaigns of Orville Freeman and Bill Carlson have been heroic campaigns against tremendous odds. They have been an uphill fight against a wall of silence, a silence dictated by the Republican Party and reinforced by the Republican press of this state. What this silence means is that the Republicans have no answer to the Freeman-Carlson campaign. The Republican administration has kept silence and has slept, while Minnesota's natural resources have been weakened, exploited, and depleted. No adequate attempt has been made to conserve or replace these resources. Industries have been leaving the state of Minnesota. Since 1948, industry has decreased in this state instead of being expanded. But the Republican leadership has done nothing about it. The population of Minnesota has followed industry. And mind you, since 1940, more than 140,000 of our good people have left our state seeking opportunities elsewhere. But nothing has been done about it. Nothing has been done about floods, which in 1952 alone washed away over $15 million worth of our people's property. Now, I want to say to those of you who are concerned about the negligence of our state administration that Orville Freeman, the Democratic farmer labor candidate for governor, has a constructive, sound, concrete program. He has campaigned on this program in every town, village, and hamlet of our state, and he has faced up to those issues which mean the most to Minnesota. The silence of the Republican administration simply means that they have not faced those issues, and frankly, that they dare not face the people and discuss the issues. Those who value their right to vote, and this is our most precious possession, and those who want a constructive state government, those people will vote for Orville Freeman for governor, because Orville Freeman talks sense to the people of Minnesota. Orville Freeman has a program which he has explained to thousands and thousands of the people of this great state. And those people who want teamwork in government, who want to support a great national administration, will send Bill Carlson to the United States Senate. Those people who believe in progress, who believe in humanitarian, forward-looking programs and liberal government, they will vote for Adlai Stevenson for president and support his hand with a Democratic Congress. Now back to the issues on the broad national level. The Democratic Party has not backed away from the problems before our people and before the nation in this campaign. The Democratic Party and its presidential candidate, Adlai Stevenson, has let everybody know where it stands. The Democratic Party has stood for the same thing in the North as in the South. It has stood for the same thing to the farmers, to labor, to businessmen, to all groups and interests which make up this country. We know where Governor Stevenson stands. He has made his position crystal clear. Governor Stevenson devoted every speech he made during the first month of this campaign to setting forth his position on the issues, outlining his program, and speaking his mind on the problems that beset us. Yes, we know where the Democratic Party stands in this campaign. The record of the past 20 years testifies to it. The platform of our party is clear and positive. The American people know where Democratic leadership proposes to lead them. Now, after all the shouting, the charges and the countercharges, there are some questions that we Americans have a right to ask. Who do we trust? What party? What leadership can we trust? The critical nature of the times in which we live demands that candidates and political parties talk sense, give straight talk and not double talk. So let's look at the record and see who and what party talks sense. And by the way, what party talks nonsense. Governor Stevenson has said that the Republican Party is a victim of a split personality. Indeed, it is. It has two heads, two mouths, but one body. It is the voice of Eisenhower, but it is the spirit and the body of Senator Robert Taft. In the East, it is the voice of internationalism, international cooperation. But in the Chicago Tribune territory, it is the words of isolationism. In the Far West, the Republican Party talks about public power. But in the stronghold of the private utilities in the New England states, it pledges protection for the private interest. To labor, the Republican voice calls for modification of the Taft-Hartley law. To industry, it is still the same old Taft policy of injunctions and cracking down on organized labor. The plain fact is that the Republican Party is not and cannot be consistent or honest with itself. How can it be? How can you mix General Eisenhower, the supreme commander of NATO, with Senator Taft, the persistent opponent of the North Atlantic Pact? How can you blend in one party protection of the natural resources for all of the people with Governor Shivers of Texas and the Tidelands resources or oil as the special resource for just a few of the people? What kind of political medicine is it, friends, that has on its label Me Too? Me Too for Social Security, farm price supports, and civil rights. And then inside of the bottle has Senator Byrd, Governor Burns, Senator Taft, and Republican obstruction and reaction. Frankly, this isn't only double talk. It is plain double dealing. I think the American people will continue to support the New Deal and the Fair Deal rather than to swallow this Republican double deal. The crowning climax of this Republican split personality was the loving embrace of General Eisenhower and Senator Taft when they met together at Morningside Heights in New York and agreed that they agreed on everything. Now, this is strange talk, for only 3 months before, they were in mortal conflict at the Republican convention. Is it any wonder that the distinguished liberal Republican senator of Oregon, Mr. Morris, stated that he would have no more of it? And is it any wonder that he resigned in disgust from the Republican Party? And that he would support a man of principle, a consistent program of liberal philosophy, Governor Stevenson, the Democratic candidate, and the Democratic platform? Now let me go on with these inconsistencies, this Republican double talk. Take, for example, on our military expenditures. Senator Taft wants to cut our military expenditures And at the same time, he wants to extend the Korean War to China. Senator Nixon, the vice presidential Republican candidate, 1 month before the Korean War, voted to cut American aid to Korea. In 1948, the whole Republican Party blamed the National Administration for not disarming fast enough. But today, that same party says that it alone foresaw the present world situation. In this very campaign, the Republican Party has claimed, through Senator Taft, that the chief issue in the campaign is the reduction of taxes. Then the very next day, General Eisenhower has claimed that foreign policy is the chief issue and that taxes cannot be reduced for several years. Let me ask you, who can you trust? What voice are you to listen to? Who are we to believe, the captive candidate of the Republican Party or Mr. Republican himself? It is becoming increasingly obvious that General Eisenhower hasn't changed the Republican Party at all. The old guard is still in control. You know, you don't build a new house by adding just a new front porch. The Republican Party, tragic to say, has changed General Eisenhower. It is doing to him what it did to Wendell Willkie. And he, like the great Willkie, will find out that he is fighting a losing battle. If the Republican candidate wishes to lead a crusade, and that seems to be the theme of this Republican campaign, I suggest that he start within the household of Republicanism. There's a lot of saving to be done right there. If the Republican candidate really believes that a change is necessary, may I suggest that he try to change Senator McCarthy, Senator Jenner, Senator Kim, Senator Malone, and some of the other Republican obstructionists. Because it is these men that have fought Eisenhower's program of foreign policy. It is these men that bitterly attacked the general while he was commander in Europe and while he sought the nomination of the Republican Party. But the general welcomes them all and boldly announces that all is well within the Republican Party. The party, he says, is united. What kind of unity is this? I'll tell you, it's the unity of political expediency, the unity of winning an election without any regard to principle or without any qualms or fears as to whom you may embrace. Now let's take a look at the record. Let's discuss the Republican record and the Democratic record. The 1952 platform of the Republican Party urges that farm prices be set, and I quote, in the marketplace. Now, whatever that means. Of course, Republicans greeted the Taft-Hartley Act as a step towards setting the price of labor in the marketplace. Republican obstruction on raising old age pensions surely indicates that they want to set those pension rates in the marketplace also. There's absolutely no reason to think that the Republicans mean anything different by the marketplace today than they did in the days of Hoover. The Republican marketplace that they talk about in their platform is the same old fire sale bargain counter of the early 1930s. It's the marketplace of 25-cent wheat and 9-cent corn. It is the marketplace for the old folks of the county poor farm. It is the marketplace of cheap labor and unemployment. And it was this marketplace that the Republican leadership guarded so jealously. And it is to this marketplace that they will take us again. And their record bears me out. Now let no one say that the job of the Democratic Party is done. This democratic prosperity and the democratic equality of opportunity that have now come to this country, or that it has come here to stay. And let no one say that the Republicans could not overturn the work of the past 20 years if they tried. This is simply not the case. We know that there is still much to be done. And friends, we know that there is still much to be lost. Now, let me illustrate this by the problem of our old age pensions. It was the Democratic Party which first took up the cause of our older citizens and took up this cause against the constant abuse and obstruction of Republican leadership. It was a Democratic administration that enacted the first Social Security law. And don't forget, that law was called every name in the book: socialistic, impractical, and economically impossible. It was a Democratic Congress which doubled the benefits of the Social Security program just 2 years ago and increased the number covered under Social Security by over 4.5 million people. Now, the Republican 80th Congress knocked off 750,000 people from the Social Security lists, and it refused to raise the benefits one dime, despite the fact that in 1948, the cost of living had raised sharply. Now, friends, the Republicans may say, "Me too," for Social Security. But had we waited for Republican votes to get Social Security, there would have been none. And in their most recent control of the Congress, Social Security benefits were not increased, not a penny. And those who were participants under Social Security were decreased by 750,000. That's the record. Now, even worse, though, the old folks on fixed pensions are threatened with high prices. Yet who was it that weakened the price control program? Who was it that tried to kill all price controls? Now, here is the record, right in the 82nd Congress. 59% of the House Republicans and 51% of the Senate Republicans voted against extending price or rent controls. The Republicans and their Dixiecrat allies, the recent recruits to the Eisenhower campaign, favored high prices, and they also favored low pensions for old folks. Yes, now as before, the Republican leadership fought to protect the special interest at the expense of the general welfare. Our Republican friends have embraced practically every general on the face of the Republic. They embraced General MacArthur, and General Eisenhower, and General Motors, and General Electric, and General Foods, and General Mills. There's just one general which the Republican Party and its leadership have never seemed to care for, and that's the general which stands as the hero of the Democratic Party, the general welfare. You see, in those good old Republican days that our Republican friends like to remind us about, there were millions of unemployed people, but there was no unemployment insurance. Today, 37 million Americans are covered by unemployment compensation. There were the needy in those Republican days, those days to which Republican leadership longs to return. There were the needy and the aged, but no old age pensions. Today, 65 million Americans are covered by Social Security, and each American at the age of 65 has a paid-up annuity valued at $15,000. There were the blind and the disabled in those old Republican days, but there was no social welfare program to help them. And Mr. Farmer, there were farm surpluses and low prices, but there was no grain storage facilities and no price supports. There were kerosene lamps, but no rural electrification. There was the stock market in those Republican days filled with speculators and unprincipled men, but no regulation of the stock market to keep it honest. Yes, in those good old Republican days, there were broken banks, but no bank deposit insurance. There were farms that were foreclosed upon, but no farm credit at low interest. Every program that has now become a part of American life was bitterly fought and hampered by Republican obstruction. If Republican votes had determined our national policy, we would still be without these great social gains. But of course, our Republican friends point to some accomplishments. They say they're the party of the balanced federal budget. This is their one claim to glory. They balanced it every one of the 12 years that they were in power. They balanced it at the price of an unbalanced diet for millions of Americans, an unbalanced family budget for millions of American families, and an unbalanced and broken American economy. Then as now, they worship the gold standard and their so-called Republican solid dollar. Well, friends and neighbors, that Republican solid dollar got so heavy and so solid that it finally broke every bank in the country. It was so scarce and so slippery that, like old soldiers, it never died, it just faded away. The record of the past is perfectly clear, and so is the Democratic promise for the future. A Democratic victory means a square deal through price controls and increased and expanded Social Security. Now let's talk farm program for a moment. This is a great agricultural state, and surely the people of Minnesota want to know where the political leadership of these two parties stands on the issue of farm policy. Democratic support for the farmer in his fight for fair prices is common knowledge today. In 1932, average farm prices were 42% below parity. In 1951, those prices were 7% above parity. Even allowing for higher costs, the average farm income is still twice that of 1929, still twice as high today as in 1929, and four times as great as in 1932. National farm production is up almost 50% since 1932. In Minnesota, production of hogs alone is up 47%. Production of cattle is up over 20%. Now let's take a look at the Republican record, because Republican farm orators are telling the American farmer that we're for the farm program, we're for 90% of parity. In fact, they're trying to embrace the entire Democratic platform. Let's take a look at the record. In 1933, less than 2 weeks after Franklin D. Roosevelt's inauguration, the president asked Congress to pass the first AAA. Despite millions of foreclosures and bankruptcies, House Republicans in 1933 voted 73-39 against the farm bill. Again in 1938, after the Supreme Court had ruled against part of the farm program, the processing tax, it was necessary to pass a new Farm Act. Republicans in both the House and the Senate voted 5-1 against it. In 1939, when farmers sought appropriations to make good the parity pledge made by Congress just the year before, House Republicans voted 135-20 against adequate appropriations for farm parity. Let's get more up to date. In 1943, when a bill was up to extend the Agricultural Adjustment Act into 1945, just 2 years, the House Republicans voted 138-10 against this short extension. You remember 1948, when the Republicans had a majority in Congress? They enacted the now discredited 60% to 90% of parity sliding scale of price supports. If that bill were effective today, Mr. Farmer, that law would put a statutory wheat price support at $1.27 per bushel, compared to $2.20 per bushel actually now effective. In 1952, when the Cooley bill to extend 90% of parity to basic agricultural commodities for another 2 years was before the House of Representatives, a majority of the Republicans voted to kill it. This is their record, and I say to you that the record is perfectly plain. It's a record of obstruction on farm policy, and a record which should tell the American farmer that this kind of political leadership cannot be trusted. Now, Adlai Stevenson has talked sense again to the American farmer on the basis of the Democratic platform, and he has pledged us, even here in this state of Minnesota, that there will be protection for the producers of perishable farm commodities, and that we will move ahead on the present program. So far, the market for perishables has been protected only by Democratic economic policies, which have maintained high purchasing power. But Democratic administrations have been willing to experiment towards the extension of price supports to farm perishables. The Democratic Party has been consistent in the past, and it will keep faith with the farmers in the future. Now, we've learned the lesson of isolationism and high tariff under Republican Smoot-Hawley Hoover policies in the 1930s. These policies wrecked the farmer and helped bring on a worldwide depression, Adolf Hitler, and World War II. You would think that the old guard Republican leadership would remember that, wouldn't you? But my friends, they seem not to remember. Today they talk again of high protective tariff, which would mean to stopping the flow of American agricultural products to the countries of Western Europe and Asia. This would mean a 25 to 35% reduction in American agricultural income. Make no mistake about it, Mr. Farmer. High tariff and isolationism are your mortal enemies. What American agriculture needs more than anything else is a flow of goods between the nations of the world. American agriculture today is greatly dependent upon an ever-expanding foreign trade. And it is to this that Governor Stevenson, the candidate of the Democratic Party, has pledged himself. The Democratic Party of Roosevelt, Truman, and Stevenson has maintained a consistent and constructive policy. It is sound at home and sound abroad. Here it is. Here is the policy and the program of Democratic leadership. The policy of Governor Stevenson today and tomorrow. Governor Stevenson and the Democratic Party believes just this, that where any section of the American economy suffers, markets are lost and prosperity withers away. Governor Stevenson and the Democratic Party believes that you can't maintain farm markets without fair wages for labor, that those who have contributed to the American economy in their youth have a right to a fair deal, a square deal in their old age, that you can't maintain an economy of fair play without controlling prices in a time of emergency. The Democratic leadership maintains that you can't have American markets without promoting world trade, and that you can't promote world trade and that at the same time pursue isolationist and high tariff policies. And finally, friends and neighbors, you can't maintain the life of freedom here at home without setting up barriers to a philosophy and a totalitarian force which will enslave men if it is given a chance. The Democratic Party is alive to the urgencies of this time in which Americans are living. It is alive to the meaning of political responsibility. Governor Stevenson, as the candidate of the Democratic Party, realizes the needs of the American people. He, like Franklin Roosevelt, believes in the people and shares with the people the great trials and tribulations of our time. In this election, you must trust the party which has placed trust in you, and trust the administration which has produced for America a prosperity never before equaled in the history of any nation.